I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The White House is sending a message to 70 different federal law enforcement agencies: no racial profiling. It's a campaign promise fulfilled, but delayed because of the September 11th attacks. And in fact, the new guidelines say that racial profiling will not be allowed in normal criminal investigations, but can be used in terrorism investigations. Eric Lischblau covers legal affairs for The New York Times. He joins us from Washington, D.C. And Eric, first a little history. George Bush, in a February 2001 speech, said racial profiling is wrong. We'll end it in America. Then he had the Justice Department do a review. What did the department find?
Well, they found that they did not believe racial profiling was a systemic problem. There were what they found to be a fairly limited number of complaints from the public, of lawsuits and things like that. But Bush had vowed to end racial profiling in what he considers to be abuses by the few. And that's where this policy comes from.
Well, and explain how it works, because, yes, it's banned in criminal investigations, but not in terrorism. Does that mean you can't stop someone who is driving while black, but you can stop someone who is driving while Middle Eastern?
Well, they've really set up two different systems here. One, as you say, for traditional, fairly routine law enforcement investigations like traffic stops, drug searches, things like that, where they're creating what they describe as a higher standard, saying that basically racial or ethnic profiling is forbidden unless there's specific information. If you're the park police and you're looking for a fleeing bank robber and you have a description of a man with a certain race, a certain age, certain hair color, certain eye color, then you can use it under those very strict conditions. Mm-hmm. But the parameters change for national security investigations, where you're talking about terrorism or border security or things like that. There is a looser standard. The administration maintains that it is still in keeping with the Constitution and the federal law, but it does allow them, for instance, if there is a report that hijackers are going to take over a plane in California in the next week, there is the allowance that heightened scrutiny could be given to men associated with the ethnic group of that terrorist group.
Well, civil rights groups have been critical of that kind of detention following September 11th, but what are civil rights groups saying about the guidelines as they affect criminal investigations?
Well, they're taking some limited satisfaction from the criminal side, but the terrorism loopholes, as they describe them, have worried many Arab American leaders and civil rights groups just since yesterday. They think that the loopholes are too large and that this will essentially be meaningless.
Yeah, some are troubled that these are guidelines and not laws. Is there a worry that this might be a wink rather than something that will really be enforced?
The Bush administration, the White House, maintains that they will aggressively enforce this. This is the first time there's been an across-the-board policy of this kind, but the concern and the charge from the other side, from civil rights groups, is that the measure really has no teeth and that there may be too many ways around it.
Mm. In your article, you give examples of profiling that will not be allowed and those that will. Can you give us another quick example of each?
Sure. For instance, narcotics officers who were going after drug dealers could not target a neighborhood just because it's primarily made up of an ethnic group that they suspect deals drugs more frequently than any other ethnic group. That would not be allowed. But if there were specific information developed, for instance, an example that they give in the policy is if there were software tracking data that pointed them to a certain neighborhood, and in conjunction with 911 calls and arrest reports, specific information apart from race, they could then go into that neighborhood, even if that neighborhood happened to be primarily of one race.
Hmm. Well, Eric, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Eric Lischblau is legal affairs reporter for The New York Times.
In his 2002 State of the Union address, President Bush passionately called on young Americans to volunteer and pledged a 50% expansion of AmeriCorps, a program begun under the Clinton administration.
Americans are doing the work of compassion every day, visiting prisoners, providing shelter for battered women, bringing companionship to lonely seniors. These good works deserve our praise, they deserve our personal support, and when appropriate, they deserve the assistance of the federal government.
That was 2002, and this week a presidential spokesman said that the president remains committed to volunteerism. But so far, Bush has done nothing about what Congress did in the budget it recently passed. slashing $70 million in funds for AmeriCorps. Now, to explore what that means for the future of the program and of volunteerism in this country, we're joined by Michael Brown, the co-founder of CityYear, the country's largest AmeriCorps program. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you.
Well, Michael, CityYear operates in 14 cities, derives a third of its budget from AmeriCorps. What does the new budget mean for AmeriCorps and for your program, CityYear?
The new budget is just devastating for national service in America. It's basically saying to so many young people who want to serve that there's no opportunity for you to serve your country domestically through AmeriCorps at a time when, with other budget cuts, community organizations are calling on young people to serve across the country.
How many young people are enrolled in AmeriCorps around the country?
This past year, AmeriCorps enrolled 67,000 young people and had to turn many others away. With the new budget cuts, it looks like only 13,000 young people are going to be able to join AmeriCorps. That's an 87% cut. Now, part of the problem is a resolution of a financial accounting issue that looks like it might get resolved soon, maybe as soon as today. But even with that, the cuts will still be devastating to AmeriCorps with as much as 50%.
Wow. Now, those numbers are impressive, but still abstract. Explain to us just what do these young people do? How important are they to communities?
In its 10 years of existence, AmeriCorps has become an essential community resource across the country. CityYear Corps members are requested at so many times the number that we can provide to schools and community centers. Children are being taught to read every day by AmeriCorps members. Those children may not otherwise learn how to read, and we know where that can lead to dropouts and to lack of success in school and in life. At the same time, AmeriCorps members are transforming vacant lots into community playgrounds. They are mentoring children. They are telling children how to prevent domestic violence, which is a scourge in our country. They're literally the yeast in the bread of thousands of nonprofits that are meeting critical needs across the country.
Now, are you trying to get the message you just put across to us so articulately to the White House?
Absolutely. And we've had a tremendous champion in President Bush. He has said in his State of the Union address that he wants to see every American give 4,000 hours of service, and he wants to see AmeriCorps grow by at least 50%. But the cuts look like they're at least 50% in the other direction and maybe more. And what we're looking for is for President Bush to call on Congress to pass a supplemental appropriations. $200 million is what's needed immediately to keep young people in service in AmeriCorps across the country.
What are your hopes for getting that supplemental help?
Just this morning, 46 senators sent a letter to President Bush asking that he send forward that supplemental request to the United States Senate. And that's a bipartisan list of senators. It's an extraordinary statement in just 24 hours since the grants were announced. We're feeling that it can be done, but it'll take presidential leadership and congressional leadership, as well as a groundswell of support from communities across the country saying that this is important.
Well, Michael Brown, thanks very much for joining us on Here and Now.
Thank you.
Michael Brown is co-founder of CityYear. He joined us from Boston.
Gay couples who aren't already there may soon be heading to Canada. Our neighbor to the north is poised to join Belgium and the Netherlands in legalizing gay marriage. Yesterday, the Canadian Cabinet acknowledged an evolution in society and agreed to draft a bill that would allow same-sex couples to marry. It's expected to pass, though not without dissent and far-reaching legal ramifications. On the line from Boston is attorney Paul Martinek. He's editor of Lawyers Weekly USA. Hello, Paul.
Hi, Robin.
Well, we reported last week on the Ontario Appeals Court ruling that prompted today's news. That ruling said that marriage is legal between two people and their gender doesn't matter. So what happens now? I mean, already more than 130 same-sex marriage licenses have been granted in Ontario in the last week alone.
What happens now is we're not sure quite what happens now. I think in the United States it's safe to say that it's unlikely that same-sex marriages entered into in Canada will be recognized in the United States. Generally speaking, Canadian marriages are recognized in the United States pursuant to a treaty between the two countries, but that does not mean necessarily that the U.S. has to recognize marriages which are different in kind to those which exist in the United States.
Really? I mean, if it does have the treaty and it says that it will recognize Canadian licenses?
Certainly, I would not be surprised if somebody challenges the U.S.'s refusal to recognize the same-sex marriage. I did a quick search to see if I could see whether there had been any legal challenges to the refusal to recognize a Belgian marriage or a marriage from the Netherlands between same-sex couples. I can't find any legal decisions, at least any reported ones, on that point yet. That may simply be because those countries are so far away that people haven't bothered to try it. Canada, of course, is in a much different category than Belgium or the Netherlands, being right up north, and therefore we expect many American couples to attempt to be married in Canada in hope that the U.S. would recognize it.
Well, they might also do that because of another interesting aspect of all three of the countries that recognize same-sex marriages. In Canada, the policy change won't require a residency requirement, so you don't have to live there. The Netherlands does require residency. And Belgium only allows same-sex marriages from other countries that also allow it. So that means if you're Canadian, you can go to Belgium, but if you're U.S., you can't.
Right. Canada is going to be a test case. I think it's unclear thus far what impact it will have legally. There certainly is not going to be a federal law here anytime soon recognizing same-sex marriages. It's going to be a state-by-state determination, at least for the time being. We have in the United States a constitution, and there is a clause in that constitution basically saying that one state has to recognize another state's marriages and other licensing events and other kinds of laws. So it's going to be much different when one United State recognizes same-sex marriages. It's going to have much more impact than Canada recognizing it, although Canada could be an important test case.
Right. And we should say that here in Vermont there are civil unions, but no marriages yet.
And civil unions have already posed quite a problem for the courts, and as each state makes up its own mind about how to deal with this issue, you're going to have basically controlled chaos from state to state trying to determine how to deal with what's been done in another state, or in this case, another country.
Well, Paul, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Attorney Paul Martinek is editor of Lawyers Weekly USA.
Just ahead, his parents were the only U.S. civilians ever executed for espionage. Now Robert Mirapol works to help other children whose parents are in prison.
And later in the program, Phoenix reacts to the resignation of Bishop Thomas O'Brien, charged in a fatal hit-and-run incident.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Mostly it comes up like in just sort of low-level social situations. You know, you're at some party somewhere and you talk to someone. They want to know what you do, you know. And I run the Rosenberg Fund for Children, and I'm the child of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. And that's not idle conversation.
He was born Robert Rosenberg, But after his parents were accused of espionage and executed 50 years ago tomorrow, 6-year-old Robert and his 10-year-old brother Michael eventually became Mirapoles, adopted by Anne, and Abel, who wrote the anti-lynching anthem Strange Fruit.
Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
That's the other thing. We went from one interesting set of parents, though our family life, the Rosenberg family was this ordinary, anonymous family who nobody had ever heard of. The only reason it was because of their arrest, that's how they became these international figures. It wasn't because they were political leaders of any sort. But I came out of that family and then ended up in another family that was very exciting and dynamic. Growing up in their household was pretty interesting.
Interesting doesn't begin to describe Robert Mirapole's life. To read his new memoir is to watch Robert wrestle with his parents' fate and its impact on him. He's at first stunningly confused, then secretive, then furiously publicly supportive of their innocence. In the end, Robert Mirapole concludes that his father probably did pass some intelligence to the Soviets. His mother did not. That none of the intelligence concerned the atomic bomb, as his accusers claimed. And that his destiny is to help other children of parents who are imprisoned or take a public stand. He calls the Rosenberg Fund for Children, based in East Hampton, Massachusetts, his constructive revenge.
Robin Young.
Hi.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
We recently visited Robert at the fund's office.
I wasn't sure what I'd expect, you know, but I see so many pictures of your parents, of Ethel and Julius.
Yeah, we've basically had art to accumulate, and we put it on the wall. You know, some of it is, here, we'll come down here. Yeah. My office.
I didn't know if that would be painful for you to have your parents' pictures, or what is that like for you?
Well, I think it's what I've come to live with. You know, of course, for me, having my parents be executed when I was six, you know, when I started being shipped around and there was all this sort of hubbub and commotion, the consistent thing throughout this period was not understanding what was going on, but knowing that something was very wrong. So my way of coping was to attempt to be as inconspicuous as possible, and hopefully it would get better. Well, you know, it didn't get better. Though ultimately it did, the thing that saved me and my brother was the community of support that rallied to our aid and created a safe environment for us to grow up in.
The principal who sent away the FBI.
Yes, the history teacher who he confided in, who made sure my parents' case never came up in high school history class. I mean, I didn't even know this, you know.
Well, I'm going to do the thing that you rightfully complain about in the book, which is ask you one of the if questions. Mm-hmm. The evidence does ultimately show that, in fact, your father was involved in some sort of espionage. Mm-hmm. How do you handle any feelings of anger or that he didn't exonerate your mother in the 11th hour, that he didn't say, I did do some things, but she didn't?
Well, that's an interesting way to go about it. The part of that question that's somewhat easy for me is I think my parents were a unit. I think they had a very strong relationship. I think that if my father was involved in anything, yeah, my mother might not have actively participated, but she knew about it. And basically, the United States would not have accepted the kind of confession you just described. The United States government wanted them, and the record is filled with evidence to support this, to say that they stole the secret of the atomic bomb. It would not have been acceptable for Julius to say, I didn't steal, neither of us stole the secret of the atomic bomb, and I did something, but Ethel didn't. They would have just killed them anyway, I believe. But for me, there was also the difficult question, you know, how do I feel about them as my parents engaging in high-risk activity, if they did do it.
Knowing that they had children.
Yeah, knowing that they had children. There are some people who wonder, who will say, well, how come you're not mad at your parents for not lying so they could, let's assume that they were innocent even, but they could have lied and gotten out and helped you, you know, and been your parents instead of being killed. Aren't you mad about that? And all I can say to that is that I'm so much I'm really glad I'm not the child of David and Ruth Greenglass, who did do that. I think David and Ruth Greenglass' children actually suffered a lot more than Michael and I did.
David Greenglass being your uncle, mm-hmm. who some would say ratted on mm-hmm. Your mother, his sister, mm-hmm. in order to win his freedom.
Yes, and then of course, it took 50 years before he finally said that the chief evidence he presented against my mother, which was that she was present during the meeting and typed up his handwritten notes about atomic secrets, that was a lie. And David has said, I had a choice, my wife or my sister, so I chose my wife. And that's what my parents couldn't do. I think my parents actually gave me a tremendous gift by maintaining their integrity. Now, I might not have felt that as a young kid, but that's the way I feel about it now. And it's that integrity that we hold on to, and it's that resistance that we're celebrating. It all does hang together.
It brings us back here to this organization, and I wonder if working with these now with these children of other activists, do you ever find yourself thinking of those parents? Why did you do this? Look what you did to the kids.
Well, you know, I try not to be judgmental that way, but, you know, the fact of the matter is my perspective is from the kids' point of view. Regardless what the parents did, I'm going to try to figure out a way to help the kids. And this fund is for children like me.
Robert Meeropol, son of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg and author of An Execution in the Family, One Son's Journey. To learn more about the Rosenberg Fund for Children and a benefit concert scheduled for tomorrow, go to our website, here-now.org.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, Bishop Thomas O'Brien of Phoenix resigns after allegedly leaving the scene of a fatal car accident.
And the Vatican, usually reluctant to accept resignations, accepts this one.
The normal calculus here is that a bishop should not step down. Obviously, the analysis then is what's happened in the last few days made O'Brien's situation in Phoenix just ungovernable.
And the relationship between detectives, murder, and food.
Whenever Nero Wolfe is trying to figure something out, he's gorging himself with chicken pie or some other delicacy.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Gina Cervetti. Another high-level former member of Saddam Hussein's regime is in custody. A U.S. official says Abed Hamid Mahmoud al-Tikriti has been captured in Iraq. He was Saddam Hussein's secretary, number four on the U.S. most wanted list. He was reportedly third in line to power in the old regime under Saddam's two sons. It's been another day of bloodshed in Iraq with both U.S. and Iraqi casualties. Lourdes Navarro reports.
One U.S. soldier has been killed and another wounded in a drive-by shooting at a gas station in Baghdad today. The gunman escaped as other soldiers tried to give aid to the wounded. This is the second soldier killed here this week. Meanwhile, U.S. forces admit that their troops opened fire on a group of demonstrators outside coalition headquarters this morning. Two Iraqis were killed in that incident. The military says the crowd was attacking with stones, passing military vehicles, and a soldier in one of them shot into the crowd. Iraqis say the shooting was unprovoked. Lourdes Navarro, Baghdad.
The Senate Intelligence Committee is meeting today to decide its next moves in a probe of what the Bush administration knew before going to war with Iraq. Critics like Democratic Congressman Joseph Huffel say the White House faces a credibility gap since no banned weapons have yet been found in Iraq.
We need to account both for what's happened to those weapons. Bluntly put, we have to figure out where the hell they are and what's happened to them. And we also have to account for what appears to be either inaccurate intelligence or misused intelligence.
A closed-door review of intelligence is planned, but some lawmakers are pushing for public hearings. The Vatican has named a temporary replacement for Phoenix Bishop Thomas O'Brien, whose resignation has been accepted by the Pope. New Mexico Archbishop Michael Sheehan will take over for O'Brien, who is charged with leaving the scene of a fatal accident in which a pedestrian was struck and killed. O'Brien told authorities he had a small amount of sacramental wine from a church service before the accident, but there was no indication of impairment. On Wall Street at this hour, stocks are narrowly mixed. The Dow is down 15 points at 93.08. The Nasdaq is up 13 at 16.81. And the S&P 500 is up 2 at 10.13. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
The spiritual leader of Arizona's 430,000 Catholics, Bishop Thomas O'Brien of Phoenix, has resigned following charges of leaving the scene of a hit-and-run car accident that left a man dead. Joining us on the line is Mark Moran, news director of public radio station KJZZ in Phoenix. Mark, thanks for speaking with us.
Sure, Bill. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Mark, Bishop O'Brien told authorities he thought he hit a dog or something, right? But his windshield was all pushed in. What's the sense of the community out there? Is the bishop telling the truth about what he thinks happened?
Well, it's almost unbelievable. It's sort of reached the tabloid stage where, you know, you go into the grocery store down the street and you hear, you know, people gossiping about the bishop. And is there a sense of whether or not he's telling the truth? I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, this guy's the leader of the Catholic Church here, so you want to give him every benefit of the doubt, certainly.
And this, of course, coming in the wake of his making a deal with authorities that he would not be prosecuted for passing priests along to parishes despite allegations of child abuse.
Right. A few weeks ago, ironically, it was the same prosecutor, Rick Romley, the Maricopa County prosecutor, the attorney here, who made this deal with Thomas O'Brien that basically said, okay, you're going to give up some of the power in the church. you won't oversee sexual abuse reports and cases in the church anymore, in exchange for the fact that, and he said, there was enough evidence to convict him of obstruction of justice, or at least charge him with it, to say, okay, you can stay in your post, but you've got to give up some of your power in exchange for this agreement, in which he said, effectively, that he covered up years of reports of sexual abuse by priests in his charge. He then later went on to say a few days later that he never knowingly oversaw decades of abuse. So there were some questions as to whether or not he ever really admitted to that.
So that aspect of possible legal proceedings of him was closed off. What is the situation now for him legally?
Well, now he faces, depending on whether or not he's convicted of these charges of leaving the scene of a fatal hit-and-run accident, which is a Class 4 felony, he could go anywhere from probation up to almost, it's like 3 3/4 years in prison. Interestingly enough, had he not left the scene of the accident, because this man was allegedly jaywalking when he was hit and killed, O'Brien probably wouldn't be facing any charges because the man wasn't in a crosswalk. So had he stopped and called police there, we may be facing a whole different situation. Again, there were some reports that the police had contacted the diocese here, and the bishop was said to have known that police were trying to contact him, and he made no effort to contact police. In fact, he was trying to get the windshield of his car fixed, which you can see in pictures is really smashed in on the passenger side. But then we started to get reports early Monday that police were at his house talking to him. They'd cordoned his house off with yellow police tape, and it was just bizarre. I mean, two completely unrelated things, it would seem, would just kind of blew everybody away.
Mark, just in the time we have left, had he been a sort of beloved figure, a respected figure over the years in Phoenix?
Well, I mean, he's been the leader since 1981, and he's always been fairly low-key. And even during the sexual abuse scandal, he managed to get himself out of any sort of legal trouble. So it's been, in fact, since this broke, it's been really eerily quiet, even around his house. You know, there's some pictures on TV earlier. There's one security guard outside of his house. He sort of stayed sequestered in his house with a few aides. And although people all over town are talking about it, it's not as though there's this huge frenzy at his house, other than the fact that TV cameras are all over the place. But
right.
It's just been eerily quiet, really.
Yeah. Well, what a situation. Thanks, Mark.
Sure.
Mark Moran is news director of public radio station KJZZ in Phoenix.
Well, Pope John Paul II accepted Bishop O'Brien's resignation today, but just 2 weeks ago, the Pope refused to accept the bishop's offer to resign amid allegations that he protected clergy accused of molesting minors. We turn now to John Allen. He's the Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter. He joins us on the line from Rome. Hello, John.
Glad to be with you.
Well, why do you think the Vatican didn't accept the bishop's resignation a couple weeks ago, but did today?
Well, the normal institutional logic is always against a bishop resigning when things get tough in a diocese. I mean, and that's for a couple of reasons. One is a theological concern, which is that a bishop is not a corporate manager. A bishop is supposed to be the father to the people of his diocese. And just as fathers don't walk away from their families in moments of crisis, neither should a bishop. There's also a political concern that if a bishop resigns under public pressure, that sort of issues an invitation for people who don't like bishops to try to pressure them into moving on. And so both for kind of a noble theological reason and a more crass political concern. The normal calculus here is that a bishop should not step down. Mm. Obviously, the analysis then is what's happened in the last few days made O'Brien's situation in Phoenix just ungovernable, and that he, in order for things to move forward, he had to go.
We understand that the Pope cited a clause of a church law that allows a bishop to resign for illness or some other grave reason that makes him unsuited for the fulfillment of his office. It does leave the impression, though, doesn't it, that, you know, leaving the scene of an accident, a fatal accident, is far worse in the eyes of the church than sheltering molesters.
Well, I mean, you know, I suppose someone could spin that argument, but that's not how I would read it. I think the reading is that, you know, Bishop O'Brien's situation was already extraordinarily difficult, and obviously there had been serious thought given, you know, despite the logic I just mentioned, there had been serious thought given to his resignation under the weight of all the problems with the sex abuse issue. I think there was a sense that perhaps this deal he signed with the district attorney might allow some healing to begin there. Obviously, that is now impossible given this new crisis that he finds himself in. I mean, you cannot lead a diocese out of crisis when you're fighting off a criminal indictment. And so I think the situation here was that the calculus was unbalanced. His situation was just unsustainable.
Right. Just too much. It's interesting you mentioned the deal with the prosecutor, because we were wondering if, in fact, that was something the Vatican might not have liked.
Well, it doesn't like it. I mean, I've spoken to canon lawyers, and canon law is the Catholic Church's own sort of body of law here in Rome that find the deal quite problematic on two grounds. One, the bishop has renounced some of his authority, in one case, putting it in the hands of an appointed layperson, a sort of child advocate, to make decisions about reporting of accusations to civil authorities. And you know, the protection of a bishop's authority is a very strong concern in Rome. And I think the other thing is, it's an open question, does the deal that Bishop O'Brien signed bind his successor? I mean, if you look at the language of that document, it's phrased as an agreement among the district attorney, Bishop O'Brien, and the Diocese of Phoenix. And there are some canon lawyers who are concerned that that the district attorney might argue that this is a deal not just with O'Brien, but whoever follows him.
Well, John, we see Bishop O'Brien's resignation, and that follows the resignation of Cardinal Law, who resigned in the wake of the sex abuse scandal here in Boston. The Vatican's got to be under a lot of pressure to replace them.
That's right, and they're in a bind because, on the one hand, they want to get their successor named as quickly as possible, the end of the crisis. On the other hand, they want to make sure they have the right man. That's why I think it's taking so long to find the successor in Boston. That's why I think it'll take some time to find the right guy for Phoenix.
Yeah. Well, John, thank you.
It's a pleasure.
John Allen, Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter.
This reminder that, as always, we love to hear your thoughts on our program. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters at here-now.org.
Or you can give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397.
And for more information on the program, visit our website, here-now.org.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Thousands of people are flocking to the parking lot of a hospital in Milton, Massachusetts, to see what some say is the image of the Virgin Mary and baby Jesus that has appeared in a window. The hospital says the image is merely condensation, but that hasn't diminished the visionary experience for many of the faithful. Here and Now producer Alan Cockle and intern Allison Vents recorded these impressions.
Well, it looks like the usual picture you see of her holding the baby or holding her son, Jesus. It's actually very clear, I think.
I see the Blessed Mother, her veil. She's wearing like the Virgin Mary statues have. And it looks like she's standing on a rock and I can actually see, like, the hands of the baby.
When I get off of my car right there, my first impression is, yes, that's image of God, you know. Suddenly, I had tears in my eyes. I couldn't control at all. And I came until I touched the walls and prayed.
The hour of our death, amen. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee.
Blessed art thou amongst women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God.
I've been back 9 times. I just can't stay away. I feel peace. I feel happiness. I feel joy. I feel love. And if anyone here that knew me personally, I'm 36 years old, a year ago was so bad in my life. I got burnt out in my apartment, was very suicidal, was very depressed. I just saw my daughter today and said, you know what? I don't need you anymore. I have no more questions. I just feel so happy ever since the first time I saw her.
It's real. It exists. Virgin Maria and God exist. It's real. They prove you pain. They prove you suffering. But they bless you. They never leave you. It is real. It is. I believe in God. And I thank God for everything because God gave it to me a good kids.
if I come from a very poor family, far away from the country, I suffer a lot in my country, and I suffer a lot up here. But I'm so proud of myself. I'm so happy because God and Virgin Maria make me strong, open my mind, give it to me a common sense, break everything out of my way for me to cut the good things day by day. I'm seeing the proof. They are real. It's not fake. God bless me big time. God protect me. God open doors and doors for me. And God never going to close the door for me.
Amen.
Never.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Talk about multitasking. Colorado caterer Goldie Schultz must figure out, was it merely coincidence that she was almost run down by a truck on the way to that big catering job at the mall? Who killed her old friend Barry, discovered under a pile of department store shoes? How will she get her son Arch all the things he wants on his birthday list? And what exactly is the role of nutmeg in the Spice of Life cookie? That last one she knows the answer to, and readers can find out all of the answers in the 11th of author Diane Mott Davidson's series of culinary whodunits, Chopping Spree. And joining us on the line from KUVO in Denver, Colorado, is Diane Mott Davidson. Hi, Diane.
Hi, Robin. It's good to be here.
Good to be talking to you. What a fun and very successful adventure you're on with this cooking combination, cooking and
Thank
mysteries.
Thank you.
and the idea of, you know, murder, mysteries, and food, it does have a long and storied history. Agatha Christie. Rex Stout,
you bet.
Why do detectives love gourmet food?
I believe that in crime fiction, you need some kind of balance to the darkness and evil that you see in a murder mystery. And so the detective will often naturally gravitate toward food, and so that food provides a kind of life-affirming balance to the darkness of the crime. So whenever Nero Wolfe is trying to figure something out, he's gorging himself with chicken pie or some other delicacy. In fact, and I love the way Robert B. Parker's Spencer is always cooking something up, like veal cutlets, when he's reflecting on a crime. Mm. And so I do believe that mystery readers love to read about food because it helps get them through the book.
And for some of us, food is equally a mystery, or cooking it anyway. And in this case, I wonder, were you a foodie first or a mystery lover first?
Oh, well, I was both, actually. But I had to learn how to cook, I have to say. When my husband and I got married 34 years ago, I had no idea how to cook. I put our first steak in the oven at 350 for an hour because that's what you did with everything. So I had to very carefully learn how to cook by watching Julia Child on television and reading cookbooks and working my way through. And then I found that I loved it.
We know that you wrote a mystery in which this Goldie Schultz was a minor character, but this is interesting because it tells us a little bit about a writer's process. You're in a writing group and they sort they pointed you in another direction.
That's right. What happened was that I took some chapters of the book that became Catering to Nobody to my critique group, and they all said, look, you have the wrong main character. Your main character needs to be this caterer. And I was amazed. But what the group said was, she's the one with the most energy. So at that point, I went to a caterer in our town, Evergreen, Colorado, very upscale caterer, and said, look, I will work for you for free if you'll teach me about catering. And I thought, of course, how hard can it be? Oh, gosh. So I worked full-time for him for a while and learned the ins and outs of catering. It's very different from being a home cook.
Well, I'll say it's different. You can get hit by a truck on the way to a catering job, for instance.
You bet.
Going back to what food does when it's introduced mm-hmm. into a story, there's also something, sensuous about food,
yes.
especially when you're, you know, there's a crime involved and there's something
yes.
a little bit obscene about somebody enjoying, isn't there, about somebody enjoying good food when there's dead bodies under piles of shoes at the department store? I mean, isn't there a little something a little, I don't know,
well,
risky?
What I think, I think perhaps it is risky, but we're not ever making fun of the crime and so on. And what I find is that when I'm thinking about anything, trying to think through any problem, and in this case, you know, Goldie as the amateur sleuth is trying to understand, why was her friend killed? Why was she almost run down by a truck? And so her mind keeps going around and going around, and the thing that helps her, and it helps me too, when I'm working on a problem, say, with writing, is that I'll say, okay, I can't figure this out just by sitting here. I'm going to go out and do some cooking. And the way that it's been explained to me is that the left brain, the critical, judgmental, analytical side of your brain, it will run your hands, that your hands will be engaged doing something like driving or cooking, and then your right brain will be free to throw out an idea.
Hmm.
And so when Goldie says, I had to go and cook, she would go into the kitchen and start cooking, and then some of the ideas will start to come to her, what it is that she needs to do or what was going on.
In fact, there's one place in the book where that's demonstrated. It's when she whips up the quiche, me quick. Quiche, could you do us a favor and just read us a little bit in and around this recipe? And what you do is you actually put the full recipes in as they're coming to Goldie. So the full recipe is there, but also the storyline continues.
Right. She's just gotten off the phone trying to figure out what happened to Barry, and she's trying to figure out what to do next, so I reflected a bit, then fluted, pricked, and baked the pie crust. I would make a quiche, I decided, and use up this morning's leftover bacon. The pie would be rich, creamy, and soothing, and would go perfectly with a field green salad dressed with raspberry vinaigrette and defrosted homemade baguettes.
I'm hungry already. So then Goldie goes on and has some phone conversations about this investigation into the various murders that are happening, and she then hangs up the phone and continues.
Then I cracked 3 eggs, whacked on my big mixer, and beat the eggs with almost a cup of whipping cream. Whipping cream, so aptly named. In cooking, you could take out your frustration by whipping, folding, beating, and smothering. And here folks thought the home cook was so docile. I piled the chopped bacon and grated Gruyere into the cooled crust, sloshed the eggs and cream over all, then artfully grated nutmeg on top.
But finally, after a hectic morning of solving mysteries and baking, the quiche is finished.
I cut myself an enormous slice and smiled after the first bite. The bacon gave the pie a lovely crunch. The Gruyere added tang and substance, and the eggs and cream gave the whole mélange a texture like velvet.
Diane Mott-Davidson reading from her latest book, Chopping Spree, which has made me so hungry that I've actually started eating the Shopper's Chocolate Truffle, which our producer slash chef, Emiko, put together some of your recipes just to see. We
yes.
trust you, but just to see if, in fact, they are wonderful.
Good.
We have some questions. First of all, you know, fans of mysteries often, you know, call the writers or the authors and call them to question on little facts. Do cooks call you and ask you about recipes or point out was, you know, a little bit something wrong with them or question them ever?
Very rarely. Every now and then I'll get something from someone who is trying to do some sort of substitution. They want to use a different kind of berry for muffins or something like that, and I'll just, you know, quickly write them back saying, yeah, go ahead, you know, go for it. Or someone wants to put a whole meal together, and so I'll help them plan a meal, a luncheon, say, for a bridal shower or whatever, using recipes from the book, which is fun for mm-hmm. some people. Over the course of the 11 books, I think I've gotten 2 letters from people saying, I made this and it didn't work. And I always write back saying, well, try this and try that,
right.
You know.
We can't let you go without remarking on your Spice of Life cookies. Again,
sure.
I felt it was my job to plow through a half a plate of them just to make sure. But how do you, for a recipe like that, do you have a test kitchen? How do you know?
Well, I have our own kitchen, and the thing is, I actually don't trust people in test kitchens, to be perfectly honest, because I think that a test kitchen is just too perfect. With the Spice of Life cookie, what happened was that I was trying to make a spice cookie that was really, really spicy, something that would just completely inflame your senses and not just be like a ginger snap, like a run-of-the-mill ginger snap. So what I did was I started testing spice cookies and ginger snap cookies and seeing, well, what would happen if you added more spice? What would happen if you doubled the spice? What would happen if you grated fresh nutmeg and added that and then doubled that? And so what I ended up with was a very spicy cookie with a buttery texture that seemed to be everybody's favorite.
I tell you, what happens when you grate fresh nutmeg is a wonderful thing.
That's right.
It's got cinnamon, ginger cloves, and the fresh nutmeg. And not to put too fine a point on it, Diane, but this cookie is to die for.
Oh, well, thank you.
It's great. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Culinary mystery author Diane Mott Davidson's latest book is called Chopping Spree. She joined us from KUVO in Denver, Colorado. And as I said, for more information, go to our website, here-now.org.
Chocolate is grand. Melts in your mouth, melts in your hand. Chocolate is love. Chocolate is here, chocolate is now. Beans from Brazil, milk from the cow. Chocolate is love.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR, Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Crudell, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna, and our editor is Mitch Wortlieb.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Matt Odette. Our web producer is Zach Christo, and our intern is Allison Vents.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
At night I dream of hot fudge on ice cream. Snickers are fine, Milk Duds divine. Häagen-Dazs chocolate chip is a trip. I couldn't survive without my Godiva. I eat a chunky when I feel funky. A Toll House cookie is best.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on technical computing software. Information on